very much. Just give me a second here to send my signal. Okay, that's fine. We've got it. Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to be back in this room again. I've been here a couple of times speaking to the women's club. And it's always a delight to have 150 women sitting in this room. We've also had the pleasure of taking two groups the last couple of years in a row out to the Carden Elvar in the springtime to see what's happening with the birds and the flowers. So it was a pleasure for me to receive an invitation to come and visit the men. And I'm sure many of your wives are involved with that club as well. But thank you for your hospitality, and thank you for inviting me today. Just a brief word about how this all came about, and it really kind of, your announcements today kind of sparked it for me, because I was out on the Elvar with my wife a few years ago, and we met a group of people who were birding, and they wanted to know where they could find certain birds. So I told them where I thought they could find them. The next week, I got a note from the leader of the group saying that they were from Port Elgin. He said, we found every bird that you said we would find where we went. And he said, I'm wondering, he said, would you be available to come and do a presentation on Carden Elvar and the birds to our festival we have every spring? This was in June, and the festival was the next May. So I said, yes, I would be happy to do that. But I needed to get some photographs from a friend of mine, Larry Kirtley, because I didn't have enough photographs to do the thing. As it turned out, 2 weeks, I figured I would have the whole winter to get this presentation together, and I found out 2 weeks later that I had prostate cancer. And so I had to pack up my bags, had surgery, and then I spent 6 weeks in Toronto going through radiation therapy. So that was 12 years ago, and here I am. So there is hope for all of us as long as we end up getting that checkup every year, because this thing kept up, I mean, very, very quickly. But thankfully, they can handle these things now if we act on them fast enough. Anyway, so much for that. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about what goes on in my neck of the woods. There's something not quite right here. Hold on just a second. It's with me, it's not with you. Okay, I'm going to have to shut this down and start all over again. Can I have the lights back on again for a moment, please? I just have to shut this off. Sometimes when the equipment sits idle for a while, it doesn't want to behave properly. Okay. Apologize for this. I'm going to shut down the entire thing and start from the beginning again. I think. I'm sorry? I'm using PowerPoint, but it's not going into the secondary monitor. It's using this as the primary. I'll show you in a second here. Never happened. This hasn't happened here before. But I haven't had this happen before, but I've had it happen at home on one occasion. Now, yeah, I know. Yeah, but it's. See, I should be getting secondary monitor here. Because I'm using notes here, and you want to see the notes. See, it should be. It was on before. Strange. No, that's to add notes. No. Well, I can click on it one bit because it's in presentation mode. See, they're not going to get it. Click on what? Yeah, I'm not getting that at all. Okay, we'll have to go with that. All right. No. Okay, I'm sorry, I don't know what has happened there, but there's something not working. But at least we can get pictures here anyway. So the presentation today is the Cardinalvar and its birds. And I can right off the bat tell you that I am by no means an expert in the field of alvars. My interest in the alvar is because of the birds that are there. And why would the birds be interested in this kind of a landscape? So that's my big interest. I'm not an expert in anything, because you know what an expert is, don't you? It's from the Latin, X as a has-been and spurt as a drip under pressure. So I'm not going to say I'm an expert in anything at all. Well, I want to start our presentation way back billions of years ago when we were told the earth was created. And we don't know how God went about doing this thing. This is a shot of a formation of a star from the Hubble telescope. And it may have looked something like that, but we don't know for sure. All we do know is that in the very beginning, our earth was one great big mass. And then over the eons of time, it separated into three distinct continents, and then later on into the five continents as we know them today. Now, it's difficult for us to imagine that living in very, very cold Canada, in the wintertime in particular, this entire area was covered by a warm tropical sea, about a mile deep. And in those seas, those warm seas, were billions and billions of different kinds of marine animals and plants that lived there. We had an ice cap, and then the ice eroded, but we also had streams of water that would flow down, and the silt and the mud from those rivers began to flow down in this particular part of the world, down what we call the Kirkfield Outlet. If you go across 48 toward Beaverton, you'll see that great huge ditch almost around Kirkfield area, and that's where the water was flying down throughout that outlet, the Kirkfield Outlet, down here to Fenland Falls, following what is now the Trent Canal system to the St. Lawrence River and Hudson River, and eventually out to sea. And all that warm water in the sea and the weight of it over time compressed that silt and mud, and it developed into a beautiful stone that we know as limestone today. And in those limestone blocks, if you go and look for them, you will find many of the skeletal remains of those sea creatures. And these are the kinds of things you will find if you go looking for them. And sometimes the quarries in the area will open their doors for people to go and look for these kinds of remnants of these skeletal remains. Now, most of them won't be as well cleaned and produced as these, because these have been professionally excavated and cleaned by professionals. But quite often, the quarries will allow the school groups and family groups to go in and search for these animals' skeletal remains. Now, when we had the ice cap over top of our area, it began to melt and recede. The glaciers started to recede. And the glacier that was most responsible for the creation of this part of Ontario was this Wisconsin glacier. And when the glacier started to recede and move back, they scraped off most of the soil off that bedrock that was there, that limestone that was created eons before. And this is the kind of formation that we see as a result of when the glacier took away that soil. And it's what we call an alvar. Alvar is a Swedish term. It has two meanings, love and limestone bearing. It's essentially an area of a natural open area with very thin soil over top of a limestone bed. Very few trees, if any, not forming much of a canopy at all. Alvars exist in Ontario, in the area that we know right here, but they usually follow kind of an arc-shaped pattern above Georgian Bay, over Manitoulin Island, down underneath Georgian Bay for a piece, servicing again on the Bruce Peninsula, and eventually across the top of Lake Simcoe around Washego, and then following down through the Carden area, Smith Falls, Napanee as well. So that's where the major significant alvar is in Ontario. This is the alvar from satellite. This is Lake Simcoe here. This is Lake Dalrymple here. Lindsay's down here. And the Elvar is this mauve-colored area, shade that you see here. And so here it is. It's a 580 square kilometer tract of land. So here's a close-up of it. Again, here's Lake Dalrymple on the left side. I live on Avery Point in Lake Dalrymple, right about where that dot is beside that island. The whole east and southeast side of Lake Dalrymple is Elvar. It's limestone. When you get to about three-quarters of the way up Avery Point, it turns from limestone into granite. So the north end of the lake are all granite little islands and granite shoreline. So this is the beginning of the Canadian Shield. Now, there's only one other place in the world where there is a significant Elvar, and that is in Estonia, up here. Kind of interesting that we were connected up there at one time, eh? Now, there are smaller Elvars in Ontario as well. There's one down on Pelee Island. There's another one in around Chatham area. And there are a number of small ones in Ohio. But the most significant Elvars are right here in Hardin and in Estonia. So on the Elvar, there are different types of terrains that exist there. You get Elvar pavements, which are the pavement is right on the surface. We get wetlands. We get large expanses of grasslands. We get forests or Elvar forests as well. There are very few acres for arable land there, but you do grow some corn and some hay. There are woodlots that have Elvar woodlots. These are trees growing out of limestone. As you can see, huge piece of limestone here with a tree growing out. Look at them growing out of here. It's truly amazing how they can grow on the top of that limestone like that. You can see here there's the erosion on the side of this piece of limestone. There is a little pathway that runs down here, and the water goes through there every spring as the water runs off the Elvar, and it follows this trail down into Lake Dalrymple. For the most part, beef cattle is the main farming activity, and you can see they have to bring the water in quite often. And this is what happens in the winter. The spring thaw comes, and the water will sit on top of that ice and limestone for weeks and weeks and weeks until the summer, and that's the same location where that picture was taken. You can see what happens when the hot summer sun starts to beat down on that limestone. All the fields turn to this brown, all the dead stuff happening here. Field after field of dry, parched ground. And if it's clay, it's all going to be cracked. It can be 90 degrees out there with no problem at all. And the poor cattle have nowhere to go because we have not very large trees. They don't form a canopy, and they will get underneath the smallest trees, little cedar trees and pines and spruces, to get a little bit of shade. Well, why are these Elvars important anyway? Well, there are only very few plants and distinctive plants that can grow in those kind of harsh conditions. That tremendous amount of heat with very little soil doesn't allow for good plant life. So we have very distinctive plants that come into the area. We also have a lot of insects. And I'm told that we have more insects per acre on the Elvar than any other landform in Ontario. And those insects bring in the birds. And so we get a lot of grassland birds that you don't find in most parts of Ontario because of the fact that we've got those insects there and the insects are there because of the plants. So these are the small shrubs that will grow in the area. A lot of hawthorns, a lot of short berry plants, and junipers, and that kind of thing. We get cedar trees. Some birch go in there, but mostly it's cedar and some scrubby pine. And in the wintertime, the deer come in to yard in this acreage that I showed you a little before. I've been told by the ministry people that we can have up to 2,500 deer in that yard during the course of the winter. I was snowmobiling one day many years ago, and I went from about here to the next intersection down here, and I counted 70 deer. So there are a lot of deer in the area in the wintertime. And they come in to take cover in the dense forest that's there, and also to browse on the cedar limbs that are there. If you drive up number 6 out toward Aurelia and look at the cedar trees that are there, you'll find there are very few trees with leaves below where my hand is, because that's out of the reach of the deer. So they come in to feed on the cedar trees that are there. And where you get a lot of deer, you obviously get a lot of coyotes. We don't have wolves. The odd one may come down from Algonquin Park, but coyotes are the main animal that we have on the Elvar in the wintertime in particular. Lovely to see against the white snow or the red fox. And we get quite a few good size black bear in the area as well. Mostly, of course, in the spring when they're coming out of their den and feeding their young, and in the fall when they're eating as much as they can so they can put on the fat to survive over the winter. So this is the Elvar. It's a very special place. It's special because it's quite unique in many respects. Here's a typical Elvar shot. And you can see for miles in some places without any trees. Some people have called it Canada's Serengeti. The only thing is you won't find any of these guys there. But you can see the similarities in the landform between the Serengeti of Africa and the Carden Elvar. It is now, however, a very threatened ecosystem. It's threatened because of an uninformed population with misuse of recreational vehicles and the general stresses put on the area as well. One of the biggest concerns is the fact that we need to have a lot of good crushed stone. We want good, solid buildings. We want to have roads to drive on. And the development of new buildings and new places. I want a house that I've got a good foundation under. I want to drive on a good road. And millions of tons of gravel are now being taken out of the Elvar each and every year. We have a number of quarries in the area, and it's because we've got one of the highest quality limestone beds, apparently, that there is. And it's very close proximity to the GTA. And, of course, with all the building that's going on down there, there are hundreds and hundreds of truckloads going out every day. All you have to do is go out on number 12 highway to see them all. A local gentleman was heard a number of years ago telling his daughter that one day Carden would be nothing but one great big hole in the ground, and was very profound and very insightful, because today that's a lot of what Carden is, a great big hole in the ground. You can see the huge expanse of the quarry here. We have a number of operational quarries in the area, and this is the kind of landscape you will see, especially if you go out number 6 toward Brecon, piles and piles of crushed stone and various grades of gravel, etc., and so forth. These white patches are the operational quarries. This was taken about 5 years ago. This quarry now has expanded right down to number 6 and over to here. This core is expanded way below where the picture is. This one is basically the same. But this is only the operational quarries. The quarry operators own much of this land within this area, just waiting for it to be developed at some future time. So they're always looking for good, high-quality alvar properties to purchase, because this particular one makes a lot of sense. It's a 500 or 600 acre piece of property. It's nice and flat. There's only a couple of inches of soil. They can easily take it away and get right at, mining that stone. So they're always looking for places to buy. And of course, there are always people in the area who live there who've got issues too. And so you'll see these signs happening all over the place all the time. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not against quarries personally. We need the stuff, right? So we need to work out some method of getting along with each other so that we can stop major development and protect these unique life forms that are there, because in many cases, they're very, very rare, and we have a lot of endangered species in the area. So the Kuchichin Conservancy and the Nature Conservancy of Canada are also looking to buy up land, and we buy as much land as we possibly can, and our goal is to have a tract of land that would be protected from Kirkfield right through to Queen Elizabeth Park. And the good news is that we have been able to purchase quite a bit of land in the area in the last few years. You will likely see Cameron Ranch if you drive up toward Orillia on number 6, a 2,800-acre Cameron Ranch, and a 1,600-acre Windmill Ranch on Wiley Road, which are both, they're connected to each other. We purchased those about 10, 15 years ago now, but now they have form, along with some other properties that we purchased, what we now call the Carden Alvar Provincial Park. It's now owned by the government of Ontario. We felt there were a lot of good reasons for us to give it to the province. One thing about it is that we've got it protected forever, and we have cattle on it on both ranches so that we keep the grass short for the birds. So this is the Carden Alvar Provincial Park. It isn't signed there yet, but a number of organizations, including the Nature Conservancy, the Kuchichin Conservancy, Carden Field Naturalists, Kawartha Field Naturalists, we all get involved in maintaining the stewardship of the property. And we have committees that work with the government in terms of their planning agenda, etc. So we've also added more properties in the last few years. This is called Prairie Smoke. McGee Creek, you'll see this on number 6 as well. The little bluestem alvar, known for its bluestem plant. This is right on the east shores of Lake Dalrymple. And some smaller properties, 300 to 400 or 500 acres, since October 2010. So now the picture changes slightly, because this is the same basic picture I showed you with where the quarries were. You can still see the quarry down here, but we have added, these are the properties that are now under protection thanks to the Nature Conservancy, Kuchichin Conservancy, Ontario Parks. In some cases, they're owned by the province, in some cases by the Kuchichin Conservancy, some by the Nature Conservancy, but we work together in managing those properties and making sure that they remain that way forever. So we're always on the lookout for more property. And as I mentioned, Cameron and Windmill Ranches have got cattle on them, and so we can't allow people to walk on them. But we can arrange tours by contacting the Kuchichin Conservancy if you wanted to tour some of those major properties. We do have, however, now we put in a parking lot at Cameron Ranch, which is just past the cutoff road to Centennial Park. on number six. We put a parking lot in there, and we built fences around the eastern side of the property so that people could walk about 3 kilometers up that side of the property beside a little creek. And we built boardwalks so that people can walk over top of the wet ground in the springtime. We've also put little parking lots on the side of Wiley Road so that we get birders off the roads and allow the farmers and ranchers to get into their properties without any problem. And we've also built a viewing blind on Wiley Road so that people can go in and sit in the shade and maybe eat their lunch and take pictures and look at birds, etc. and so forth. And if they're inside without a white sweater on, like my wife had on here, the birds won't see you particularly. So it's a good thing. I was in a blind like this in England a number of years ago and came back, and I thought, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had something like that here? So we had one of the pharmaceutical companies offer to pay for it, so we built it out of steel so that it'll be there over the winter and not have somebody set fire to it when they're out snowmobiling. Now, the Cardinfield Naturalist is mainly an educational group of people, and what we do, we do take tours onto the different Alvar locations and go birding and looking for plants and that kind of thing. And we always get professional biologists or naturalists to lead those kinds of groups, including a fellow by the name of Dr. Paul Catling. Paul is now with Food Canada, but he is an Alvar specialist. Well, we've talked about the Alvar, what it is, what makes it, you know, the Alvar, some of the threats that are there, and what we're trying to do to ease that problem. But I'd like to just turn my attention for a moment in a little different direction, because the plants form a big part of what the Alvar is. And in 1975, when Paul was at the University of Toronto, he brought a number of biologists up to the Alvar to study the plants and found that there were 430 different vascular plants growing on the Alvar. And it's one of the richest for Alvar plants anywhere in the world. And you might say, well, how can they possibly survive? You know, in those harsh conditions, how can plants thrive? Well, the perennials, they grow early in the spring and set their seeds and flowers at that particular time. And then the perennials, I think I said perennials, I meant annuals. The perennials, which is this plant here, the perennials have got very deep roots. And they can find little cracks and fissures in the limestone and get their roots down deep enough to get moisture and what they need to exist. And the other thing is that with those deep roots, it also protects them from surface disturbances such as cattle grazing and that kind of thing. So they can survive, and they do quite well. We also have a lot of different kind of plants you'll find in the wetlands as well. The springtime, late May, early June, in the Alvar is a profusion of color. You will see plants there that you don't see anywhere else in Ontario. See the color that's existing there. And it's amazing, because look at this little daisy growing out of this huge piece of limestone. It's got a little hole. That's all it needed to get its roots down in to get moisture. Many of the plants, as I said, are unique to the area. And so we have a number of people who are really interested in botany come to look at flowers. One of the members of the Conservancy wrote a book a few years ago on Alvar plants, and people use that as a study guide now when they come out to the Alvar. So these are some of the plants that you might find there. all kinds of beautiful flowers, none of them lasting maybe that long, but they are there at the right time. But I'd like to draw your attention to these two images here. On the left is a plant called prairie smoke. It's a member of the rose family, and this is what it looks like in flower. It almost looks like a bud, but that's the flower. And this is what it looks like when it goes to seed. It's a very interesting plant, very seldom found anywhere else but around here. And as you drive through the area, you will see that mauve. And I'm sure many of you have seen that color in the fields up in around the north of Kirkfield. This is a prairie smoke. And this is what it looks like when it goes to seed. A very beautiful plant, and in the wind, it'll just wave back and forth, undulate back and forth. It's such a unique plant to the area that the Cardinfield Naturalists use the prairie smoke as the title for their newsletter and as a logo. Now, the wetlands also attract a lot of insects. And as I said, we've got more insects per acre than anywhere else. One of the insects that people find very interesting, of course, are butterflies and dragonflies. And every year, a local naturalist, Bob Bowles, carries on butterfly and dragonfly counts, and they found 75 different kinds of butterflies and 67 dragonflies. Amazing. So if you're interested in butterflies and would like to go on one of these walks that he has every year, I can put you in touch with Bob. Well, the Cardin Alvar is now rated as an important bird area, and it's a place where people come to visit every year because there are 238 species of birds to be found here. And no matter what road you go down, you're going to find something really quite special there. Many people come from all around the world just to add to their life list. People do that, you know. They keep lists of birds they've seen. They go all over the world counting birds. I know of one guy. There are about 10,000 birds in the world, and he's now up to 9,000. He likely spent a few million dollars doing it. So these people come from all over the place. I've met people from Japan, from New Zealand, from all across North America. As a matter of fact, one day I was out, a doctor came. I introduced myself to a doctor. I didn't know he was a doctor, but he was here only to see an upland sandpiper. So he came from Texas just to see an upland sandpiper. It's amazing. Now, the Cardin Important Bird Area Group put together a little map here, which you see. It's a map of the area, and there are little keys on the map. And the keys will tell you, if you flip to the back part of the pamphlet, there's the back part, the keys will tell you what birds you'll find in certain areas. And this map's available on the Kuchiching Conservancy website, but I have a number of copies here if you'd like to take one. They're really interesting because you can... It'll tell you how to get around the whole area to see these different birds. I'd like to thank my friend Larry Curtley, a professional photographer. He used to have a cottage up in Colby, but has recently moved to Blind River. And when I put this together, Larry graciously let me use some of his images because I didn't have quite enough to do the job. Well, with all the lakes and marshes around, we get a lot of water birds, of course. Lake Dalrymple, we have 5 pair of loons. And there are loons in all the lakes around the area. We have 5 pair. They normally don't all nest every year. We've only got 2 that are nesting this year. Last year we had 4 that nested. But loons don't need to nest every year because they live for 15 to 25 years. So there's lots of time for them to reproduce themselves. Plus, the other thing is that high water in the spring will wash away the nests sometimes, so not every year will you have 5 pair, but we do have lots of loons around the area. We do have also the pie-billed grebe, a funny little bird. You see him now and then he's gone. He just ducks underwater. along with his cousin, this little Greek. Now, most areas in this part of the world now have cormorants who visit. Wasn't a while ago you didn't see any cormorants at all. My wife and I were getting on the ferry on Pelee Island a few years ago, and it was a rainy, rainy day, and I sat near the window, and I looked out the window, and there, outside the window, outside the boat, there was a flock of cormorants that was as wide as from here to the other side of the theater, and the flock went on for 15 minutes. Hundreds of thousands of cormorants going back to the U.S. with very full bellies of Canadian fish. Now, here's a guy you won't see very often. Anybody know what it is? Sorry? A bittern, yes. American bittern. You hear them likely before you see them. This is a black-headed white heron. We don't have too many of them, but they're a beautiful bird to have. And a green-backed heron. Now, these are a beautiful bird. We had a pair nesting in a tree down on our one shore a couple of years ago. And we learned very quickly that if you want to have a conversation on your back deck when they're raising their young, forget it, because they make so much noise you can't even talk to your wife. Here's another guy, a great egret. We don't get many of them, but they come through. Beautiful birds. We have lots of great blue herons around. We have within 5 kilometers of Lake Dalrymple, there are 2 heron rookeries. One of them with 125 herons on it, and the other one much, much smaller. But none of them have any leaves on the trees, and if you get to a heron's rookery, there will be no plant life around the base because their excrement will kill everything. The same way that the cormorants have done that to all the vegetation on the Leslie Street split in Toronto. We've got trumpeter swans now nesting on Dalrymple. We got actually 5 cygnets this year. We will skip this one. We have lots of puddle ducks around as well. Mallards and green-winged teal and pintails and shovelers and wood ducks. All kinds of puddle ducks. And we have lots of diving ducks as well. This is a little bufflehead. And notice how Larry was able to capture the wonderful iridescent feathers on this little bufflehead guy. Hooded merganser, beautiful birds. Well, they're all beautiful birds. All kinds of ducks that visit us either the spring or the fall. Now, the cleanup crew has arrived. This in the form of a turkey vulture. And it wasn't that long ago that we never saw turkey vultures here at all. But they have slowly moved north, and you can see them quite often on the thermals as you're driving down the roads. Their wings are up like this in a dihedral kind of form. And they are scavengers. They come in and clean all the dead kill off the roads, the roadkill. And they'll follow the tractors when they're cutting hay hay or corn or whatever, because they'll pick up dead animals or birds that they kill when they're mowing or cutting. Here's another scavenger. We don't like to think of it as a scavenger, but it is. Bald eagles have made a tremendous return to our neck of the woods. This guy was eating a deer that got hit by a car about 1/2 mile from me last winter. So he was picking the bones. The coyotes had been there during the night, and this guy came in to feed in the morning. I'm happy to say that a pair of eagles this year have built a nest on the island behind us. And here they are. This was taken in February. The pair of them building their nest. We watch them every day, And we knew that they had eggs, and we knew that they were incubating the eggs. And sure enough, we saw a little head poke up one day, and then the leaves came out, and then we haven't been able to see them since because they're right in a bush. But I was out in the boat a couple of weeks ago, and by this time the young chick had grown to the point that he was standing on the edge of the nest. And the other day, for the first time, we saw him flying. So we're really happy to have the eagles. Now, most parts of Ontario have done really well with the comeback of the osprey. Beautiful bird. You see them all over the place anymore. But just about every hydro pole has got an osprey on around the lake. And I was fortunate enough, I have a friend who has a farm across the lake from me, and he's got a osprey nest on a hydro pole on the road. Unfortunately, just beside the road, there's a big hill. And I was able to get permission to go up on the hill and get hidden in the bush up there and get pictures of the osprey caring for their young. Now, we got lots of hawks and merlins and falcons around. And we also have a lot of rough grouse. You see them more in the spring or the fall than we do any other time of the year unless you go out in the bush. In the wintertime, you see them quite often against the snow. But in the fall, the young male birds are chased away from their siblings, and they go looking for territory for themselves. And so if you're ever in grouse country in the fall, be very wary of them because these young male birds are just like a 14-year-old kid, right? Kind of reckless, and they fly like this all over the place, and they crash into buildings, and they kill themselves and do all kinds of strange things. But we have lots of rough grouse around the area, as well as, of course, turkeys. Another big comeback story. We've got, you see hundreds of them in a flock anymore. One day, my wife and I were coming home from Brecon at the grocery store, and it was in the middle of winter, and here in a cornfield off to the right side, there were 93 turkeys in single file going across the field in between the rows of corn. Now, we've got Sora rails and Virginia rails in the area, if you're lucky enough to see them. And we have this wonderful bird, which you hear long before you see them, if they're flying. And these are sandhill cranes. Now, sandhill cranes are back in the area. We've got at least 5 pair nesting in our area. This pair, interesting, they're very rusty color. And that is because they have been feeding and then preening themselves in an area very high in ferrous oxide. So if you see them in the fall coming from the north, most of them will likely be kind of gray. But you do see the odd one, and this pair had been preening in ferrous oxide soil. Now, you'll see more killdeer than any other kind of sandpiper, but we do have spotted sandpipers, and we have yellow legs. But people come from all over North America to see this bird, the upland sandpiper. And this is a typical pose of a sandpiper. He'll stand on the fence post and look around like that. They're a wonderful bird. We have about 200 breeding pair of them. In the springtime, you may see American woodcock, especially in the evening. The male bird will take off from his lek, a little dance floor area he has, and you'll go circling up into the sky and then fall down back onto his lek and go beep, 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 trying to convince the lady around him that he's a good male to have. Now, here's another very interesting bird. It's called a Wilson snipe, and you see lots of these on fence posts around Cardin as well. Now, the first time I saw this bird with his bill open like that. It was in the spring of the year, and I had gone to bed and woke up. I woke up thinking to myself, how does that bird open his bill when he's got it pushed in the mud to try to get worms and insects out of the mud? Have you ever taken scissors and put them in the ground and try to open them? It's almost impossible. So I couldn't sleep. I got up, went down to my library, got a whole bunch of books out. There was nothing about how it can feed itself worms. So we had just recently, this is a number of years ago, recently got internet. So I went on the internet, and I found something really interesting. That the bill of the snipe, like most other birds' bills, and like your fingernails or keratin, and it's very hard material. But the tip of the bill on the snipe is made out of a very flexible material with lots of sensors in it. And they're able to stick their bill down and determine if there's a worm there by the movement, grab onto it and pull it out. So really interesting, and I never did go back to sleep that night, but it was a revelation to me. Another interesting thing about these birds is that during the days of the market hunting, and people used to go to the markets to buy, you know, songbirds and sandpipers, this kind of stuff, this bird was one of the most sought-after birds because it apparently had a much sweeter, tender taste than many other birds did. The only one problem was they were really hard to shoot because as soon as they take off, they take off, they zigzag up and down, and so only the best hunters could ever bring them down. And these guys became known as snipers. And so that's how we got the term snipers for our crack shots in the military and in our police forces. Thanks to Wilson Snipe. We got lots of gulls in the area, of course. A black back, we have herring gulls, ringneck gulls, and we have lots of terns as well. Caspian, common terns, black terns, and one of our favorite all-time winter birds, of course, is the mourning dove. Here's a bird that won't pose very often for you, a black-billed cuckoo. And many people have never seen a cuckoo, but if you want to see them, you've got to come to Carden. We got lots of owls as well, great horned owl, barred owl, great grays sometimes in the wintertime, saw-whets, and, you know, we got all the other little owls. Excuse me. And, of course, we get the snowy owl in the wintertime. I had been down here because I heard there was a snowy hanging around the airport. I came down. I couldn't find the owl. So I was on my way home, and I went up through Argyle. And this guy was flying from post to post to post in Argyle. So I got a shot of him. Now, this is a nighthawk. As a little boy, I called them Boomer the Nighthawk because of the booming sound it makes when it dives. It's the air passing through the feathers. And as a little boy, my father was a clergyman, and we were in Perth, Ontario at the time. And in the summertime, as a little guy, I would always sit in the back row of the church next to an open window so I could watch and listen for the boomers. Never did hear my father, of course, but certainly did enjoy Boomer the Nighthawk. Now, everyone's enamored by the rose-breasted, or the not rose-breasted, the ruby-throated hummingbird. Now, this bird, as females got constantly bad hair days, the Baltic kingfisher, northern flicker, great to see them come back in the spring. the only flicker, the only woodpecker that migrates. We also have downies and hairies and the odd red-headed. And lately, we're getting a lot of red-bellied woodpeckers. Beautiful to have them, as well as Woody himself, the pileated woodpecker. Now, we've got lots of insectosaurs, birds that eat insects. Eastern kingbirds, we got hundreds of eastern kingbirds in the area, phoebes and peewees and all kinds of little flycatchers, as well as the great crested flycatcher. Much bigger bird, this is about 11 inches long. Here's a red-eyed vireo. This guy has been known to sing 20,000 songs in a single day, and he doesn't even have a hymn book. What a delightful bird this is, eh? A rascal. The horned lark are one of the earliest birds to come back in the spring, and you'll see them on the side of the road picking up little bits of sand and gravel off the road. Swallows are one of my favorite birds, a tree swallow in particular, this guy here. I used to have 40 nest boxes on our property, and every one of them would be full. And now we have two families this year. It's because of the decline in insects that we've had a problem with the birds. So they're not coming back the way they used to. This is a barn swallow up here. We've still got a lot of barn swallows in the Cardin area. We used to have martins as well, and most areas are declining in martins. But we had a bad storm back in 1995, took down my martin house, killed all the young birds in it. The adults left and they never did come back again. What a beauty to see in the wintertime. What would winter be like without a chickadee? They'll even sit right on your camera, you know, this little guy. Red-breasted and white-breasted nuthatches, also known colloquially as an ass-up bird, because their ass is always up. They're pointing down. Here's a delightful songbird. The song is delightful, I should say. And this is the house wren. If you've ever heard the song, it's a marvelous, marvelous song. But the guy is a real rascal. Here he is, trying to build in a nest box on my deck. That little twig is about 12 inches long. And here's the problem with these birds. He eventually got it in there. But these birds will build in every nest they can find, on top of other birds' nests, on top of their young, on top of their eggs, right? Kill them if necessary. And he'll have maybe 10 or 12 or 15 nests already built. Then he goes and gets his lady friend, takes her around to show her, you know, the housing situation. And if she sees one that she likes, she'll invite him to be her mate. If she doesn't find one that suits her satisfaction, she'll take off. She'll leave him. She'll find somebody else. But if she does find one that she likes, she will accept it and accept him, and then, of course, she'll go inside and rearrange the furniture. There are lots of birds in the marshes as well, and this is a little marsh bird called a sedge wren. Beautiful little guy who stared at me for about 15 minutes one day. Ruby-headed, it's a senior's moment here. I've forgotten. Anybody know who he is? Oh, it's one of those things, eh? It's a blue-gray gnatcatcher. And one of my favorite birds, of course, is the eastern bluebird. I had never seen a bluebird until about 35 years ago. And I was invited to give a presentation at a conference in Brandon, Manitoba. So a guy picked me up at the airport in Winnipeg, and we were driving out to Brandon, and I saw all these boxes on the fence line, and I said, "What's in that?" He said, "Bluebirds." I said, "I've never seen a bluebird." He slammed on the brakes. We got out of the car, and I walked over to the fence where the nest box was, about 5 feet away from him, and in a few seconds, a beautiful male eastern bluebird came and sat on the fence line, and a few seconds later, the female came. So I fell in love with bluebirds that day, came back, and I said to a friend of mine, "Let's build some bluebird houses." He said, "There are no bluebirds here, David." I said, "If you build it, they will come." At the same time, there was a friend of mine, I didn't know then, but a fellow by the name of Herb Furness, who lives over on Lake Simcoe, he started to build bluebird houses. So between the two of us, we put up about 300 bluebird houses, and now we've got bluebirds all through the Carden area. And he has now fledged 3,500 little bluebirds in the last 20 years. It's amazing. This is one of the young ones. They're beautiful little birds. But there are other thrushes that we have in the area as well. Wood thrush, veeries, flinks, and struss, and thrush and hermit thrush. And, of course, the American robin. Now, here's an interesting secret of birds called the great catbird. You'll find those in the little hedges along the road. Very secretive, but you can always tell them by their cat-like sound. Now, here's an interesting bird. They're now back in the area as well. Not too many of them, but they're here. This is the northern mockingbird. This is a bird that is well-named because it can mimic so many different sounds. One guy was wakened up one morning at 5 o'clock. And he thought, when he woke up, he thought, "What's going on here? I heard the alarm, but it's not time to get up yet." So he checked the alarm for the next night. Same thing happened the next morning. This guy was mimicking his alarm, and every morning he was setting it up. There was another incident that happened where a farmer was doing hay, and he had a bee going out in the field. And they had a dinner bell on the back porch. And as soon as lunch was ready, the wife would ring the bell. One day they all came in. They didn't have watches with them. They didn't believe in wearing watches. Heard the dinner bell, came home. The wife said, "What are you doing here? It's not time for dinner yet." He mimicked the sound of the bell. I don't know why they ever called this guy a brown thrasher. I think red or fox would have been better, but he's a beautiful bird. We've got quite a few of them. Now, here's a bird we love to hate, right? European starlings, just terrible. But look how beautiful they are. It's really quite a beautiful bird, but we don't look for that. Here, it truly is a beautiful bird, a cedar waxwing. And if you've got a high bush cranberry bush in your yard, and the berries are there, they won't be there for long if a group of these guys came by. We are blessed in Carden to have 25 species of wood warbler. Beautiful little warblers, most of them about that big. Very, very high-pitched sounds. I can't hear any of them anymore because I'm pretty deaf to birds. And we've got 25 or 28 different species of them in Carden area. Another fellow you won't see too often is scarlet tanager. They're high in the canopy, and unless you hear them first, they're kind of hard to see. 17 different species of sparrows, and if they're in the field guide for the area, they're likely in Carden. Lots of little brown jobs. This is the rufous-sided towhee. At least that's what I call it. They've now changed the name to eastern towhee. But this guy you will hear long before you see him in the leaves, scuttering around in the leaves, making a lot of noise. Another beautiful bird is a rose-breasted grosbeak. And of course, one of North America's favorite birds, on more Christmas cards than any other thing, is the male northern cardinal. And he is beautiful. But look at her. Isn't she lovely? Indigo bunting. We have about 80 pair in card. And bobolink. A lot of areas don't have bobolink anymore because we've lost so many grassland areas. But we still got a lot of grassland area in Carden area, and bobolinks are still there, and there's a fair amount of research going on in bobolinks in the area right now. Eastern meadowlarks, beautiful bird. Wonder if Vancouver Canucks hockey team, remember when they used to have those sweaters with that V on them like that? Maybe they were thinking of eastern meadowlark. Of course, red-winged blackbird. Another bird we love to hate is a grackle. But again, what a beautiful-looking bird he is. Now, here is a terror. This is a brown-headed cowbird. They're a western bird. They only recently, in the last 7,500 years, come east. Now, the reason I say he's a terror, and it's because of this. This pair of birds are not very good parents. What they do, they go around to another bird's nest, likely a little bird, like a sparrow or a warbler, and they will lay their egg in amongst those eggs. It's a much bigger egg, and so when it hatches, it's a big bird. And so the parents of those little egg birds, they spend all their time feeding that cowbird to the point that the little birds likely will die, or this guy's little chick will kill them. So that means there are no little warblers coming out of that nest, but there's going to be a big cowbird. But that's only part of the story, because that female will go around to about 20 more nests and do the same thing. So you can see the number of little birds that are dying because of these criminals. Brown-headed cowbird. Beautiful bird, Baltimore Oriole. Most school kids know the bird, but kind of confusing sometimes what it is. It was called Northern Oriole for a while. Now they're back to Baltimore Oriole. And I'm sure Lord Baltimore would not be amused by the name of changing the name around like that. This guy won me a photo contest a couple of years ago as he was eating an orange on our front deck. Purple finch. I don't know that it's purple. I think it's more like, you know, raspberry, but they're beautiful birds. And the chameleon of the north, the American goldfinch. In the wintertime, of course, it turns kind of olive green color. And the miners down in Kingsville used to refer to these birds as flying rats. These are English sparrows. But I guess if you live in the city and that's the only bird you have, then they're nice to have around. Now, I'm sure you're saying he forgot to talk about one of the reasons why so many people come to the Carden area, and that is to see one of the most endangered species we have around here, the eastern loggerhead shrike. And here are eastern loggerhead shrikes looking for prey of mice and insects and little birds. And they really love hawthorn bushes. So this is a hawthorn bush. And you can see the large thorns here. It gives them a place to build their nest. But the other thing it does is it gives them a place where they can impale their prey. They impale their prey on a hawthorn so that they can tear it apart. And the reason why is because they have typical songbird feet. They don't have like raptor's feet, which they can grab onto and pull. So they need something in order to hold the prey while they tear it apart. And they're really adept at tearing apart because they've got this hawk-like beak, raptor-like beak, which can tear the meat away and then feed it to their young or themselves. So here's a little, looks like a cricket or something he's got in his mouth and feeding it to the young. Or when the young are out of the nest. Now, there has been an organization called Wildlife Preservation Canada who have been working in the Garden area for the last 15 years or so now, and they're working on the recovery of the loggerhead shrike. And for a number of years, they were captive raising birds that have been injured. There's one here and one over here, in cages, out of sight of people, never around people at all. And they were fed, you know, insects and mice and that kind of thing in the cage. And then in the fall of the year, they would take the young birds out, band them, and release them. And so over the years of the captive breeding program, they raised over 3,000 young or 300 young birds and released them into the wild. So this little guy was found in a mite-infested nest one day. The mites had already killed his siblings. So the biologist took him home, hand-fed him until he was able to fledge, and he's been in the captive breeding program for a number of years, and he's had a number of young birds as offspring. So these are loggerhead shrikes, one of the most endangered birds we have, and there's still a few around, about 25 pair in Ontario, and we've got more than half of them in Carden. So if you'd like to come to Carden, maybe you'd see a loggerhead shrike, and I hope you enjoy your time when you do come. If there are any questions, I'd be only too happy to try to answer them for you. Thank you.
Have you made a book of all these birds?
No.
In the big library, I got a $55 book. All the Canadian books in.
No, I haven't done a book on these birds. I did textbooks for years, but I wrote a book on Costa Rica, and I wrote a book on the loons of Dalrymple, but not on these. No.
The economic development lady for the city, of course, the lake tours and everything. Does she have any involvement with people in marketing this?
We've done a number of things together. You're talking about Deborah Sowell?
Yes.
Deborah, a friend of mine, another photographer friend of mine and I, we're going to do a workshop, two-day workshop last year, and then again this year as part of the tourism development thing. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough people sign up to financially make it viable. But we're aware of that. We've had Deborah out on the Alvar a number of times. She does what she can. I'll tell you the biggest problem we've got in Carden right now. Wylie Road, which is known as one of the best birding sites in Canada, in North America, when the city took over Carden Township in the amalgamation, they refused to do anything to the road because there was only one house up that road. And they graded to that one house. But all the rest of the way up, nothing's been done. The old township used to grade it twice a year, used to put fill in when they needed to. But the township or the city said it's now an unassumed road. So going up the road in a car anymore is just terrible. As a matter of fact, I've only been up once this year, and it was with the group of women from the Provost Club here, because I just didn't want to wreck my car. It's so bad. But the city will not do anything about it. And yet, we've got between 40 and 60,000 people a year come to Carden to see birds. But you see, in Kirkfield, we've only got one little restaurant, a couple little stores. There's not very much for people to do there. They can't stay there. Well, Mackenzie Inn from time to time. But there are no other amenities around. Part of the problem. But the road is the biggest factor. And we've gone to the city, but deaf ears.
Your book on Costa Rica, what exactly
does that do with? It's birds, just birds. Yeah. It's now out of print, I think, too.
Comment on the whippoorwill.
I'm sorry?
Can you comment on the whippoorwill?
We have Still have a few whippoorwills around. And I know this year there was a survey done. I wasn't part of it, and I haven't heard the results of that. But there are still whippoorwills in the area, for sure.
What about whiskey dads?
What about?
Whiskey dads. Have
Gray J. Gray J. No Gray J's left in Cardin that we know of. There used to be a pair up on County Road 43, I think it is. And the woman was feeding them there every winter. But we haven't seen them for a while.
Some people call a robin a thrush, isn't it? But there's one more than robin. Like I said, the European robin.
It's not the robin that is in the UK. It's an American robin, yeah. British robin is a much smaller bird. It's got a different colored chest, too. But when the first peoples arrived in North America, they saw it and said, oh, it looks like a robin. So it kind of stuck as a robin. Any more?
I never spoke to any of the aquarium operators. I know in some cases, preservation plans would be to create an Alvar.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm talking about the Coochie. When I say we, I'm talking about the Coochie Conservancy now. We have very, very good relationships with most of the quarries. They come to our meetings when we're talking about what's going on in the community. They're very helpful. They're very supportive. We're working together on some of those reclamation efforts and looking at their plans and working with them in the development of it. So we've cultivated a really good relationship with the quarries. Yeah, there's no animosity there whatsoever.
How does the Alvar rank with bee habitat?
Bee habitat? There's only one person I know that's got bees out that area. I can't really speak to that. But I know there's honey for sale there, so they must be doing something. I think it wouldn't even come close to being next to a clover field, you know. I can't answer the reason why. We've got lots of goldfinches in our area yet. It could be there's not enough food there for them. I don't know what the people are feeding. Sometimes if you're feeding Niger, Niger is very susceptible to fungus and to rot, and then the birds won't even come near it. I had to dump out a whole bag of Niger a couple of years ago because the birds weren't coming to it, and I found out there was mold in it.
Yeah,
so.
And it does get that mold.
Yeah. So that could be a problem, too.
Did you ever get the Port Elgin to deliver your
box? Did I ever go?
Did you ever get the Port Elgin to deliver your
box? Yes, I did. Yeah, as a matter of fact, four times. Yeah. Anything else? Well, please.
What's the depth of the limestone?
Gee, I couldn't tell you, but it seems to me that most of the quarry operators, the quarries I've been in, they seem to stop at about, I would say, maybe 60, 80 feet deep. But I don't know how good it is, how deep it is, that it's good stuff. Or maybe it's just not economical for them to go any deeper because they can keep spreading out, you know. But I can't answer that. Okay. Well, thank you again. And if you'd like one of these, please avail yourself of it. We'd be happy to have you take them.